Thanks for listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Driving Forces, where we always bring you the deeper discussion about the issues and people shaping our community and our country. I'm Celeste Katz Marston, here with the effervescent Jeff Simmons. Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Celeste. Wonderful to be with you this week.
Thank you so much. And speaking of this week, as I always say and always mean, there is a lot going on in the news. Of course, if you are listening to WBAI right now, that means you survived another Super Tuesday. Congratulations. Nikki Haley, the former Republican governor of South Carolina, has suspended her underdog campaign against former President Donald Trump. But both Trump and President Joe Biden are scrambling for Haley's supporters. And even though she didn't win many states, she does have her backers, and both campaigns would love to have them in this amazing race. Closer to home, of course, we are looking at the mobilization of the National Guard to keep the subways safer. Governor Kathy Hochul says she wants to send 750 Guard members into the transit system to check bags. That's in addition to mobilizing 250 MTA police officers and state troopers to help quell the violence on the trains. Now, the governor's also talked this week about putting cameras in conductor cabins and banning people from the subways for 3 years if they're convicted of attacking an MTA passenger. Now, these moves may play well with commuters who are afraid to use public transit in the wake of some very violent attacks. On the other hand, some groups like the New York Civil Liberties Union say it's an overreaction and an overreach. Jeff, what are you thinking about today?
Well, first of all, on that topic, I've noticed a significantly steeper police presence on the subways, especially here in Jackson Heights recently. But what has been on my mind is I'm looking forward to seeing the State of the Union tonight, Celeste, because in the wake of this poll that really has, by Emerson College polling, that has Biden and Trump neck and neck. When you don't factor in the independent voters or those who are undecided right now, they're neck and neck at 45% each. You know, it really is going to be telling, people are going to be watching every single, not even just listening to what Joe Biden says, but how he delivers this, because as you probably have recognized as well, there's a lot of concern being raised about whether the current president is fit for another term. So people are really going to be watching to see how vital how much vitality he has tonight, Celeste.
Yeah, and that's going to be interesting. And, you know, we can talk about this a little bit more. And we've just actually, we did recently a show, thanks to you, Jeff, on aging and, you know, talking about, you know, the fact that some people are concerned, apparently, about how President Biden is behaving or his affect or his speaking and whether he is fit for the job. Interesting whether or not there's an equal amount of concern for the almost equally long-lived, shall we say, former President Donald Trump. So not sure if there's any comparison to be made there. And of course, Jeff, speaking of the former president, lots of news about him as well, as far as some of his business dealings and his legal situation, bringing it back to kind of the local angle, which we are going to be talking about on today's program.
Yeah. And by the way, I mentioned that about where voters would swing. I want to just tell you, because I find this very fascinating, Celeste. I don't know if you've had a chance to go through the poll, but the folks that were supporting the Haley primary voters, they break for Biden in the general election, 63% to 27%. So that's going to be really interesting to watch.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
And independent voters, let me bring that up too, because I pointed that out. Independent voters break for Trump. 42% to 39%, but still it's 19% who are undecided. And with the undecided push, Biden's support then would increase to 52% ahead of Trump, who would get 48%. So it's really going to be interesting to watch this. But again, tonight, lots of pressure, I would think, on the current president right now to really define himself on both a domestic and foreign agenda, because he really has to get significant support. And remember, wasn't it during the last State of the Union where he was heckled or booed by a number of the Republicans? Really curious what's going to take place in the audience tonight.
Yeah, and I've been seeing some of the releases going out about who the guests are going to be and who everybody's bringing and what kind of statement they're trying to make. You know, whether it's about the Israel-Hamas conflict, or if it's going to be about women's issues, you know, the right to choose an abortion or things like that. So yeah, and you know, it always gets to be, I mean, there is a reason why the State of the Union is a very serious thing, but there is a reason why we call politics, political cycles, the silly season, right? Everyone's always trying to one up. And I'm, I don't know, Jeff, I mean, from a personal standpoint, it's like, how do you even watch a State of the Union without like the pregame show, like starring Elliot Engel? Like, I just remember that being such a, it's such a fundamental part of my job, you know, as a political correspondent for the Daily News, for example. But, you know, it's not the same somehow. It is very weird, but, I'm trying to make the best of it. And we'll see if there's going to be any antics or any outbursts, or if there's going to be an issue there or not. But I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And one of the announcements that's supposed to take place tonight, according to Associated Press, is that Biden is going to announce, and I know our listeners are going to be interested in this. He's going to announce a plan for the U.S. military to establish a temporary port on the Gaza coast, and that would increase the flow of humanitarian aid for the territory during the war. That's according to administration officials. They spoke to AP on the condition of anonymity to preview this announcement, but they said that this operation will not require that American troops be on the ground to build a pier that is intended to allow more shipments of medicine, of food, and other essential items, Celeste.
Absolutely. Jeff, you know, I want to talk about this more, but we are going to have to like roll right along onto our next guest here now. So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Driving Forces with Celeste Katz-Marston and Jeff Simmons here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. Now, today we're going to have a really important conversation about some of the things that we're talking about a little earlier in the program, but specifically, I mean, local news. And first, just a quick reminder, this is People Powered Radio. This is a local community station. Please help this station and this show stay on the air. Go to WBAI.org today and become a BAI buddy in the name of Driving Forces. You can sustain us with a gift in an amount that's right for you. Just go to WBAI.org today, right now, and become a BAI buddy in the name of this program, Driving Forces. That is WBAI.org. Thank you, and we appreciate your help. So we're going to get into today's topic right now. And I just want to say, you know, I started my career as a reporter in local news, very, very local news, as a matter of fact. When I was a student, I worked for a tiny weekly newspaper about an hour north of the city. Jeff, what was your first newspaper job, actually?
Well, my first one was delivering community life in Bergen County, New Jersey. But then I worked for the Record of Hackensack. People knew it back then as the Bergen Record for about 10 years.
So I think we all know, and we all grew up with some paper, and maybe it was a big paper, maybe it was the Times, but maybe it was a local paper in Brooklyn or Queens, Long Island, wherever it may be. My first job, grown-up job anyway, as a reporter, after I worked for a little local weekly about an hour north of the city, my first grown-up job was as a reporter for the Providence Journal in Rhode Island, where I covered places you may have heard of, like Newport, and some places you may not have heard of, like Johnston, which is home of the state landfill. My first assignment was the town of Little Compton, Rhode Island, which had a population of about 3,000 people at the time. And I think we were selling about 300 newspapers at the time, but 3,000 people in the entire community. Of course, in the city, that's about how many people might live on your block and the next block, just for comparison. But eventually, Jeff and I actually both went on to work at the Daily News and a bunch of other big outlets. He worked for the New York Post and New York One. I worked for Newsweek, Condé Nast, and so on. But we both learned a lot from our time in local news, including the fact that local news really matters. It matters to a community to have reporters watching to make sure that politicians, government agencies, the school system are accountable. It matters to have someone to call who will actually pick up the phone and talk to you when something is going wrong. So there have been a lot of local news startups in recent years, and that is great, but not all of them survive. It's competitive. It's expensive. It's complicated. Meanwhile, big chains are cutting staff. Hedge funds are buying out newspapers that have served cities and towns for years and gutting them. Reporters are getting laid off. And the result of that is that it's harder and harder to know what's going on right in the place where you live. So to help us really understand more about why this matters and why some local news outlets are thriving, even in tough times, we're happy to be joined right now by Dan Kennedy. Dan is a professor of journalism at Northeastern University in Boston, and he is a nationally known media commentator. He's here today because he's also the author, with Alan Clegg, of a brand new book, What Works in Community News, Media Startups, News Deserts, and the Future of the Fourth Estate. So Dan Kennedy, great to have you here with us on Driving Forces.
Thanks for having me.
So, big picture, we thought we'd ask you, the expert, how worried should we be about the state of local media? You know, there are some bright spots, and you describe this in your book. There are local newsrooms starting up, but, you know, there's a lot of outlets that are just being torn apart by hedge funds and chain orders, and also a lot of startups don't make it. So how worried should we be right now?
Well, we certainly ought to be worried. There's no question that news deserts are spreading. Something like 2,900 newspapers, most of them weeklies, have shut down since 2005, and that's about a third of the total. At the same time, though, we have seen hundreds of local news startups in recent years. I've been following this space for about 15 years, and we're really seeing the trend toward independent local news startups accelerate. And what we see are for-profits, non-profits, but the commonality is that they're controlled by the people in their communities, and they're really providing their residents with the news and information that they need, frankly, to govern themselves in a democracy. And if it weren't for these local activists, it wouldn't happen.
Dan, it's great to have you on the show with us today. You and Alan did deep dives on a wide array of outlets. How did you and Alan pick which outlets to examine? What were you looking for?
Well, you know, honestly, we picked about 12 projects in 9 parts of the country, and we easily could have picked a different list. What we were aiming for was we wanted geographic diversity, so we have both coasts, we have the heartland, we have north and south. We wanted diversity of size, so we have a couple of large projects, a few very small projects, and we wanted a diversity of business model, for-profit, non-profit, diversity of community. So we do have some affluent suburbs in there, and those are the places where it's easiest to do this sort of project. But we also have rural communities and urban communities of color. And so we think we've got a pretty good array of projects. And we also have most of what we looked at are digital-only news organizations, but we also have tiny radio stations, a couple of legacy daily newspapers, and even a large public television station that merged with a politics and public policy website.
So, Dan, I just want to go back for a couple of seconds. And if you're just joining us, our guest right now here on Driving Forces is Dan Kennedy. He is the co-author of What Works in Community News, Media Startups, News Deserts, and the Future of the Fourth Estate. It's out right now from Beacon Press. So, Dan, just go back for a second. For people who may not know, first of all, what is a news desert and why should we be worried about that?
Well, news desert is a term that probably goes back about 20 years at this point, but it was popularized by Penelope Abernathy, who's at Northwestern University. Mm-hmm. And her definition is a county that lacks any source of local news and information. And she also is casting a baleful eye on counties that only have one source of news and information. And if you look at the map that she's put together, and she updates it every year or so, you see that news deserts are spreading, and they really do tend to be in the rural areas in the middle of the country. Those are where the problem is the worst. Now, of course, a lot of places are not particularly dependent on county. And here in Massachusetts, where I am, and in New Jersey, where we did some reporting, you really need to have a news outlet in every single municipality. And that is a real challenge. We have 351 in Massachusetts, and I believe New Jersey has about 550. That's a really tough lift, but every one of these little places, and some of them big places, have their own local government that needs to be watched over.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. And just for disclosure here, y'all, by the way, even though I am a born and raised New Yorker, I spend a lot of my time in Massachusetts these days, you know, some family stuff going on here. And I am the news editor of one of the kinds of newspapers that Dan is talking about here. It is a small, nonprofit, nonpartisan, hyper-local paper called The Concord Bridge in Concord, Massachusetts, like, you know, the one where the revolution started. So very, very interested to learn from Dan here, as I hope we, as we all can. But Dan, going back, one more thing that you mentioned when you were talking about news deserts a moment ago, but also the, you know, the disparity of which communities get local media outlets and which don't. And I know Penny Abernathy has talked about the things that sort of give a new community news organization or a startup a chance to survive. And one of them is being in an area where there is, sufficient income or sufficient economic development or the prospect of it. So, I mean, who's losing out here?
Well, as I said, the toughest nuts to crack are rural areas and urban communities of color. That said, we reported on a couple of rural projects that are at least keeping their heads above water, the Storm Lake Times pilot in Iowa and the Mendocino Voice in Northern California. In addition to that, there are several urban communities that are getting very good coverage from projects like MLK 50 in Memphis, Tennessee, Sahan Journal in Minnesota. Sahan Journal is particularly interesting. They're a nonprofit that covers the African diaspora in Minnesota. Minnesota is the home of a very large Somali population. And one of the ones that I reported on, the New Haven Independent, certainly, you know, New Haven is the home of Yale, and it has there's certainly money in New Haven. But at the same time, it's a low-income community. And what the New Haven Independent has managed to do over the years is add a low-power FM community radio station to what it offers. And they have 30 or 40 hosts on their radio station, nearly all of whom are people of color, and really adding to the vibrancy of the media scene in that city. So, yeah, a lot of these areas in urban and rural areas are underserved, but there are some good news stories out there as well, and I hope that our project may serve as a way of inspiring people in similar communities that they can try something too.
And if you just tune in, this is Driving Forces on WBAI 99.5 FM New York, also streaming live at WBAI.org. Celeste Katz-Marston and I are talking with media commentator and professor Dan Kennedy, co-author of What Works in Community News, Media Startups, News Deserts, and the Future of the Fourth Estate, out now from Beacon Press. Of course, I want to jump right into New Jersey because, you know, I spent so much of my life, well, not just growing up there, but working for a newspaper there. And the evolution of news has just been so dramatic. I mean, the paper that I worked at for just under 10 years, the Bergen Record, is nothing like it was back then. But you talked about an innovation, something called Spotlight. And I want to just quote from the book. What Spotlight can do is serve as a beacon for other public broadcasters on how to provide high quality regional and statewide news. Talk about how this model is working in New Jersey.
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting model, in fact. About 10 years ago, John Mooney, who I actually worked with very early in my career, refugee from the Newark Star-Ledger, left and started a website devoted to covering politics and public policy. And that, you know, they went along for 5 or 6 years and they were doing okay. But they really needed a jolt of energy and money. And they obtained that by essentially merging with the operation that's now known as NJPBS, the big public broadcaster in New Jersey. And today, you have a pretty interesting mix where the resulting news organization, which is known as NJ Spotlight News, features a number of video clips from the TV station on their website. And they also have a half-hour daily newscast on the TV station that often features stories from NJ Spotlight News and often features journalists from that operation as well. And given New Jersey's rather unique position as a really big state that doesn't really have its own media market, they're trapped between New York City and Philadelphia, NJ Spotlight News is filling a real and real void.
Dan Kennedy, we I'm curious to know a little bit about a couple more things, actually. Well, first of all, just in terms of the mechanics of how these local outlets work, you wrote about a neighboring newspaper of the Concord Bridge, the Bedford Citizen, and you have some really great details on how it works. And you made a very interesting point about how a paper like the Bedford Citizen and maybe other papers like it, you know, rely very often on volunteers and older people, people of retirement age. I think in the Bedford case, we had somebody who was far beyond retirement age and, you know, more power to her. But, you know, what are some of the benefits and some of the dangers of local media outlets that are trying to get traction and inform people, but are relying on older people or people who are not getting paid to do that work?
Yeah, the Bedford Citizen's copy editor, Dot Bergen, I believe, is now 100 years old. And so that is quite an accomplishment. She does her copy editing from a retirement community in Vermont. The Bedford Citizen started as a volunteer project. And as you say, they were dependent upon retirees. It actually started with three people who were in the League of Women Voters. And I think that when you are in that situation, you need to figure out how to move on to the next level and become a sustainable professional news organization. And they've been able to do that. At one point, a professional fundraiser, Terry Morrow, joined their board, and she began to figure out ways that they could raise money. They get it from membership fees. They get it from Newsmatch. They get it from an annual publication that they put out called the Bedford Guide that goes to every home in the community and is just filled with ads. I will say, unlike your project of the Concord Bridge, the Bedford Citizen has never really been able to generate large gifts from foundations or high net worth individuals, which I have learned is nonprofit speak for rich people. But they nevertheless have become sustainable. The original editor, Julie McKay Turner, has moved on. Her place has been taken by a veteran Gannett editor who had lost his job, Wayne Braverman. And today the Citizen has a full-time paid editor, a part-time paid staff reporter, and paid freelancers. Now, they still have volunteer contributions as well, but I feel like they've made that leap into becoming sustainable and not being wholly dependent on retired volunteers. They have the heart of the Bedford Citizen today is paid journalism.
And I think that's really important. And I think we have time for one more question. I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about this one, Dan Kennedy. But speaking about having retirees or people of retirement age and volunteers. Now, when I was coming up 5,000 years ago in local papers, the idea was to work at a local newspaper only as, you know, as long as you had to until you could get out and go somewhere, quote unquote, bigger and better. And it's been an interesting, I've sort of come full circle being back in community news, which has been an adventure, and I'm all for it. But I think when I was coming up, at least, there was a real mentality of local news was not somewhere you wanted to spend your career. Local news was a place that you could use as a springboard. You wanted to get out of there and get to wherever you were supposed to be, or where it was cooler to be or more exciting to be. Do you feel like there's any change or been any change or could be any change in that mentality? And what's going to make that shift?
I think that there could be. And I think we may get back to the mentality that prevailed a couple of generations ago, which is many of the journalists working in local news were people from the community or people who moved to the community and decided they were going to stay there. If you look at a number of these better funded nonprofits, they're paying competitive salaries. They're certainly paying more than the corporations and hedge funds did that used to employ many of these journalists. And as the next level of the news business continues to shrink and be unstable, I think a lot of younger people are finding that these are some of the best jobs out there. And that it's a great way to make a home and to make a living and to serve their community, whether it's a community that they grew up in or a community that they've adopted. I certainly hope that's the case. You know, one of the values that Ellen and I are really pushing in our book is the idea of community and civic engagement. And when a news organization is really rooted in that community, that is a key part of making that happen. And you just can't have staffs, you know, moving through every couple of years and expect to have that succeed.
Dan Kennedy, I wish we had more time. I have so many more questions that I want to ask you. I'll have to email you and set up a call to follow up. But for the moment, well, you know, because this really speaks to me. All of these things really speak to me, from starting out in local news and then going off and doing more national stuff and then being back in community news for a lot of the precise reasons, actually, that you mentioned. But for now, Dan Kennedy, where can people find out more about you and your brand new book, What Works in Community News?
Well, thank you for asking me that question. We are online at whatworks.news. And in addition to finding out more about our book there, you'll find updates that Ellen and I post about developments in local news. And you'll also find out how to subscribe to our podcast, in which we interview entrepreneurs and thought leaders in this space. So we kind of look at our book as being the hub of several projects, but the other projects enable us to keep current and offer new information as it develops.
Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time. And if you know any local reporters who are smart and aggressive and want to write for the Concord Bridge, please, for God's sake, let me know, because we are growing and we could use all the help we can get. But for now, Dan Kennedy, thank you so much for coming on the program today and talking to us about your new book, What Works in Community News. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Celeste and Jeff. I really appreciate having the chance to talk about it.
Thanks so much, Dan. And if you just tuned in, this is Driving Forces on WBAI 99.5 FM New York, and also streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm your host, Jeff Simmons, joined by Celeste Katz-Marston, and we're going to continue the conversation now, because Celeste and I have been doing Driving Forces now for about, five and a half years. Since we launched this show, of course, you know that we often bring you talks with incredibly talented reporters from the nonprofit newsroom the city. People like Jose Martinez, who talks about transportation, or Ruvain Blau on justice and prison, the prison system, and anything to do with Rikers, Greg B. Smith on public housing. Well, that list goes on. In a relatively short time, the city has had a really big impact on how we understand New York City, and it's done a very impressive job, but that hasn't come without some real challenges. So joining us now to talk about that is Nick Dawes. He's the city's executive director, and he's responsible for growing the organization's reach and impact and leading its strategy for revenue and business operations. Nick Dawes, welcome to WBAI's Driving Forces.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
So to begin with, tell us just a little about your extremely interesting background and how you came to work with the city.
So I was a reporter for many years in South Africa, political and investigative reporter, and eventually the editor-in-chief of a national newspaper there called the Mail and Guardian. And so I went from that job to run a big newsroom in India at the Hindustan Times, where I spent 3 years. Amazing thing to be able to do, very different from what I'm doing now in some ways, and very similar in some other surprising ways. And then I spent a few years learning the ropes of nonprofit work at Human Rights Watch here in New York, where I helped to run that organization's global operations and to raise money and think about how we could have impact. And I'd been doing that for a number of years, and I was increasingly convinced that the place where the most impact happened was closer to home and through deeper connections with communities and the ability to look public officials in the eye when you're raising issues that concern them. And I also saw how profound and deep the crisis in local news was, and at that time, how relatively less noticed against the larger crisis in national news. And when the opportunity came up to lead the city, it seemed like an absolutely perfect challenge to me to link those objectives of building deep local civic engagement off the back of really high-quality journalism and ultimately producing better, more equitable outcomes for everyone who lives in this city that I love so much and have come to call home.
So, Nick Dawes, thank you so much for being with us here today on the program. Really appreciate you taking the time. I'm interested to know, you know, we talked just a moment ago with Dan Kennedy, who wrote a book about what works in community news. And we talked about news deserts, which is a term that has come into popularity when people are talking with concern about the state of local media or the lack thereof, people not getting served. Now, New York City is not necessarily what somebody would naturally think of when they think about a news desert. I mean, I've worked in New York City media for a long time, Jeff has, and it is super competitive. The field seems very, very packed. So, you know, curious to know, you know, when you're doing this in New York City, what sets you apart? What are you trying to bring that either people are not doing well or not doing at all?
Yeah, so I'll say two things about that, Celeste. One is that the news desert is a useful rubric for thinking about places where there's no news at all, but it doesn't fully describe the depth and the nature of what we're dealing with in the collapse of local news. And there are many places, like New York City, where there are still publications, but where what you have is a really profoundly compromised and inequitable news environment. So in New York City, we used to have the tabloid duopoly of the News and the Post. We had the Times, and we had a pretty thriving local broadcast sector. Now the Times has set its sights largely on a national and global horizon. The Daily News, owned by a hedge fund, has really been hollowed out. A local broadcast faces all the pressures of the move to streaming. And the Post is really an ideological project, kind of a media super PAC of Rupert Murdoch. So you have a very, very distorted competitive landscape, even though there are lots of outlets still, and a really incomplete coverage mix, which, and this is the next point, leaves huge swathes of New York City completely unserved. How many stories do you see from Brownsville or East New York or Eastern Queens or parts of the Bronx, even, you know, the further reaches of Manhattan don't get a lot of coverage? And where they do, often it's from the perspective of people who are not from those communities and who are either trying to feed a hyper-polarized national discourse or to kind of almost sometimes it feels like send a foreign correspondent, you know, across the East River to Queens. So, at the city, we're trying to do the opposite of both of those things.
You know, it's interesting because as you're talking about that, I'm thinking the last time I saw really significant local coverage was when we had DNA Info around. And I know that the city has a few of your journalists who are at DNA Info, like Katie Honan. One of the things that that really has been on my mind has been whether people will pay for journalism. Now, the city has made a concerted effort to remain free. You do not charge anyone to read your stories online. Does that change the way you can cover New York? Does it make you more important to certain groups or communities that you're providing this service for free?
It's really, really important to us to remain for free. The number of people who are either able or willing to pay for a news subscription is vanishingly small. And in a hugely inequitable place like New York City, that means that the people who can pay are the people who get served. So we want to go where the impact is and where the community is and to keep our sights on delivering better outcomes through our journalism and reaching communities that are underserved. So because our incentive is not to super serve the most affluent, our incentive is to generate impact and to be in conversation with communities. That means we can go other places and we can cover other things. You know, there are officially around 450,000 people in the NYCHA system, unofficially maybe 600,000, more residents than the state of Vermont or Wyoming, which get two senators. Greg B. Smith, whom you mentioned earlier, is the only reporter in town who dedicates almost all of his time to that system and its hundreds of thousands of residents. You don't do that if you are indexing most heavily on an audience that can pay.
I think that's a huge point, and it really is interesting to me. As somebody who has spent many, many, many years reporting on New York and government and politics, as has Jeff. You know, I remember being literally the only reporter at Board of Elections meetings regularly. And right. This is, you know, millions, 4 million registered voters in New York City deciding the outcome of all these contests that were going to, you know, relate to what laws we lived by, and just nobody was showing up. So it is sort of bizarre. And, you know, maybe just talk for one more second before I ask a harder question. But I do want people to know we are big fans of the city, and we do want people to know about you and about your work. You know, Greg B. Smith, certainly standout reporter anywhere he goes, but for the city writing about public housing, are there other series or beats that you really want people to know about? This is your moment to kind of, you know, spotlight what people should be turning to the city to find out about.
Yes, for sure. So we cover New York City housing from public housing through particularly rentals, again, not necessarily, really deeply. And we look at every aspect of housing from rent regulation through predatory real estate speculators moving into gentrifying neighborhoods and buying homes out from families of color. We cover housing really deeply, and I would encourage anyone who cares about that issue, which should be everyone in town right now, to look at our housing coverage. Our coverage of the migrant crisis, Gwen Hogan covers that story really from the ground up and from inside of the shelters out, and her work has resulted in real accountability around the quality of shelter folks are getting. But it also helps to reset the frame and to tell the story without the politicized hysteria that accompanies a lot of that coverage. And again, I think that's an incredibly rich resource. You know, in addition to the investigative work, the coverage of the mayor that we've done, we do not rely on leaks from the Southern District. I really believe very deeply in our service journalism, our explanatory journalism, journalism that aims to help New Yorkers figure out life in the sometimes very tough town. How do you get your heat turned on when your landlord won't do it? What is a safe e-bike battery, and how can you charge and store it? What can you do about flooding insurance if you're a renter rather than a homeowner? That kind of journalism, which really seeks to help people out, and I think, and we believe at the city very strongly, builds trust. Recently, when we covered Superfund sites in New York and the potential effects of climate change on the cleanups at those Superfund sites, we sent out hundreds of postcards to people who live in the neighborhoods that might be affected, people who might not read us, inviting them to come to a public meeting at the Brooklyn Library Central Branch to talk about the issues affecting them. People showed up, having received our postcard, had never heard of us before, learned about what was going on in their neighborhood. So all of that kind of work, you know, I think these are some of the most important themes affecting New York City life. And the fact that we cover them is one part of it. The way that we cover them from the neighborhoods up and communities up is the other.
You know, and I want to jump in with one other thing. Rachel Holiday Smith's reporting has been incredibly helpful about everything to do with voting and early voting and you know, and ranked choice voting. That was very helpful in explaining it for a number of people when they had asked us, when they were a little confused about what ranked choice voting was. I was like, go to the city's website. It will explain it for you.
That's awesome to hear. Yeah. I call Rachel our chief explanation officer. She really leads that whole vertical of explanatory and service journalism, which we see as just as important a pillar as our investigative and accountability reporting.
We're talking to Nick Dawes, executive director of the nonprofit newsroom, The City. And Nick, you know, despite all the incredible stories that you've done, the coverage that we appreciate that actually helps people live better lives and know more about how to navigate the place that they live, you know, obviously you are facing a lot of the same financial pressures as other sectors of the media world. So talk about what that has meant for you and for the outlet and specifically for the reporting as well. You know, are you still able to do the work that you want to do and do as much of it, or is that changing?
So I'll start by saying we have some amazing people who support us, and those are people who give us hundreds of thousands of dollars and people who give us tens of dollars. Nearly 5,000 New Yorkers send in small contributions to us every month, which makes up about 15% of our budget. A really, really extraordinary vindication of our work, and some, you know, as you said earlier, wealthy individuals and foundations really believe in this work and are supporting it. But what we do is really expensive. As you discussed with Dan, we aim to pay people a decent wage that you can live on in New York. You don't have to be a trust fund kid to work for us. And you don't have to be banking on graduating out to the Times to work for us. You can make this work your passion and your career. So that costs money. We do deep investigative journalism, data journalism, interactives. You know, you mentioned the ranked choice work where we created this complex online quiz game. All of that costs a lot of money. And I think, you know, it's fair to say that it's really, really hard to keep that going. Not everyone yet appreciates the importance of news as a philanthropic category. You can raise over $500 million to renovate a concert hall at the Lincoln Center that serves, you know, maybe a few tens of thousands of people. We're seeking to raise in the middle millions to serve the whole population of New York every year. And it's tough. We have to convince people that news is a public good, that the commercial model is broken and no one is coming to save it, and that we need a mix of revenues that includes philanthropy, this amazing reader support, a bit of advertising, to deliver the kind of quality reporting that New York City needs. And we are hanging in there. Our reporters are incredibly dedicated and committed. And we have some funders who have really stayed with us and helped to see us through. But we're not doing what we would like to do. You know, we have a team of about 30 people. We should have a team of 50 or 75 or 100. The Daily News used to have a newsroom of 300. And we're just about hanging in there at 30. So we are delivering our most impactful work ever. More people are reading us than ever, but it's very, very tough and it's fragile. And, you know, I don't want to try to turn away from that. We have to sweat every day to keep it going. And, you know, I'm very, very hopeful about our future, but there is absolutely no letting up on convincing people of the value of this work and getting them to back it with their dollars.
And Nick, in the final minute or two that we have, given what you just said, what lessons might other nonprofit local outlets take away from this conversation? And what can they learn from what your experience has been?
I think two things. One, on the impact and audience side, is that if you combine listening to communities and listening to your audiences with really rigorous investigative reporting where you choose your slot and you don't try to replicate what other people are doing, you look for impact and find your lane and go after it really hard, you can have extraordinarily out-of-the-blocks impact relative to your size. The other is that you really need to build a plan for sustainability and have diversified revenue in every way. Have a lot of different people supporting your work, and grow as steadily and manageably as you can so that you don't get too far over your skis and find yourself in trouble.
Nick Dawes, we always wish we had more time, but for the moment, where can people go to find out more about you and the work of the city?
So please come and visit us at thecity.nyc, super easy URL to remember. And I would encourage folks to sign up for our newsletter, The Scoop, which is just a fantastic daily dose of New York. It's a bit of hard news, a bit of weather, some free events, and some stuff you won't find on the website. About 70,000 people read that every day. I'd encourage folks to come to the site and sign up for the newsletter and learn more about us.
We will do that, and we encourage everybody to do the same. Nick Dawes, thank you so much for joining us here today on WBAI. We really appreciate it, and we really appreciate the work that you do.
I appreciate your attending to these issues and having us on. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Driving Forces here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. Great conversations right now. What did you think, Jeff? Really great conversation with Dan Kennedy, co-author of What Works in Community News, and then Nick Dawes, executive director of The City.
It was taking me back. I remember when I used to cover the Board of Adjustment, the Board of Ed, and the City Council, like running across a parking lot to hit all three meetings in Teaneck, New Jersey years ago. And I'm sure we don't get that anymore, that type of coverage.
Oh, my God. I know, but we need it. We need it. Somebody's got to keep an eye out. So in the few moments that we have left here, we are going to open the phone lines right now so we can hear from you. Give us a call, 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Get in on this conversation. What do you think of what's going on in local news? We're going to be right back with your calls. You are listening to WBAI New York. For a dramatic re-entry, of course, A Day in the Life, the Beatles here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm Celeste Katz-Marston here with Jeff Simmons and with you, if you would call in, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. What do you think about the local news you get? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it totally absent? Let us know, 212-209-2877. Of course, you always have the spectacular option of just going to WBAI.org and making a donation, becoming a BAI buddy in the name of this program, Driving Forces. But Jeff is mostly in charge of that, right, Jeff?
In charge of what, Celeste? In charge of what?
In charge of getting us the money.
Oh, yeah. See, it took me a second there. I was getting a text from our program director because she was letting me know who to thank on air for giving donations to us for this show and support of this show. So let me thank a few of the people. Alex Stanton and Sam Natapoff, thank you so much for supporting Driving Forces. Also, let's see, Kristen Shaughnessy, my former colleague at New York One News, donated some money to contribute to support Driving Forces. And also another former New York Oneer, Roma Torrey, donated money to support the show as well. Thank you all so much for supporting Driving Forces. And please, if you would like to support this station and this show, please make a contribution. You can give a call to, well, I'm not going to give the number now because we're giving the call number, but you can go to WBAI.org or give to, and that's the number two, WBAI.org, and support this show. Remember, you are keeping us on air. Celeste and I have talked about this for some time. If you can believe it, we have to pay $17,000 a month to be able to transmit our signal from the top of 4 Times Square. So every penny, every dime, every dollar that you donate, we hope you give a lot more than that, helps support not just this show, but supports WBAI. So please do your part.
Listen, if you're listening to WBAI, you're a particular kind of person. You care about New York. You care about free speech. You care about social justice, racial justice. You care about free and fair elections. These things matter to you. It matters to you to have a school system that works for your kids. It matters to you to have a police force that keeps the city safe, but treats people with respect. And, you're probably a train rider, right? You want to have safe trains, but do you want somebody to check your bag and stick your hand in your backpack every time you want to get from here to there? So think about that. These are the kinds of things that we talk about right here on this program. Today we had a great program about local news. This is a local news station. This is a community radio station. Jeff and I are volunteers. We do not get paid. We have been on the station for about 5.5 years now, but we need your help to keep going. The station is not going to support itself. We need you. Please go to give to, that's the number two, WBAI.org. Become a BAI buddy in the name of this program, Driving Forces. That's give to, the number two, WBAI.org.
And I know we're going to have to wrap up very, very shortly because we only have about a minute or two left. That is our program for today. Thanks to our special guest, Dan Kennedy, co-author of What Works in Community News. Thank you, Celeste, for booking him. It was very, very insightful. And also Nick Dawes, executive director of the nonprofit newsroom, The City. Also, as always, thanks to our engineer, Reggie Johnson. And of course, again, thanks to the listeners who've shown your support for this show and this station. I know if you're giving to this show, you're helping Celeste and me, but no, you know what? You're helping the station. You're keeping WBAI on the air, and that is what matters most. So thank you to our listeners. Thank you to our supporters. I will be back here on Sunday morning with my co-host, Carlos Menchaca, and another episode of City Watch. We have a great guest, Harvard Law professor and former presidential advisor, Cass Sunstein, who is the co-author of a new book called Look Again, The Power of Noticing What Was Always There. He and his co-author investigated why we stop noticing both the great and not so great things around us and how to dishabituate at the office, on social media, and at the voting booth. That's 8 o'clock on Sunday. You know politics is going to be a good part of this conversation, Celeste.
Remember, it's almost tax season. Tax season is upon us. Your contribution to WBAI is tax deductible. Do yourself a favor for your tax bill. Do the city of New York a favor for meaningful discourse. Go to give to, that's the number two, WBAI.org. Support this station and this program, Driving Forces, today. If you missed any part of the show, you can find Driving Forces on Apple, SoundCloud, and wherever you get your podcasts. This has been Driving Forces with Celeste Katz Marston and Jeff Simmons. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned to WBAI for more great programming. We'll see you on the radio.